Welcome to Radio Sefarad's English Corner. I'm your host, Linda Jimenez, bringing news and other features of Jewish interest to Radio Sefarad's English-speaking audience in Spain and around the world. Our trivia question for this week is, what new, non-invasive techniques are being used in archaeology, and how are they helping researchers to learn more about the Holocaust? Dr. Richard Freund is the director of the Maurice Greenberg Center for Judaic Studies and Greenberg Professor of Jewish History at the University of Hartford, Connecticut, in the United States. He has directed archaeological projects in Israel and Europe, including in Burgos and Cádiz, Spain, and a research project at the extermination camp at Sobibor, Poland. Dr. Freund is the author of 6 books on archaeology, 2 books on Jewish ethics, over 100 scholarly articles, and has appeared in over a dozen television documentaries. He's about to begin a new project in the historic Great Synagogue of Vilna in Lithuania. Dr. Freund recently visited Madrid, where he spent Shabbat with the Bet El Masorti congregation. He spoke with English Corner about his own research and some new and exciting developments in archaeological techniques.
Thank you very much for speaking with us. You are an archaeologist and you've worked in many different places. Do you have a specialty or an area of special interest as an archaeologist?
Well, it depends on the project. Right now I'm working on 3 separate projects, one in Israel, one in Greece, and one in Spain, and I'm going tomorrow, on Sunday, to Lithuania to begin an excavation of the Great Synagogue of Vilna. So it depends on the project. I have a team of people that we've been working with for the past 30 years, and we take projects that we think we can do something on. Some of them have great Jewish interest. Some of them are just archaeological projects, but it depends on the project.
I know you've directed or worked on 6 projects in Israel and at least 3 in Europe. Could you briefly tell us about them and if any particular one has stood out for you?
Well, I'm in one of these very strange positions where I'm working right now in Rhodes, Greece, on 3 Jewish famous synagogues that were destroyed in 1944 and that go back to the origins of Sephardic life on the island of Rhodes. And that just in itself would be enough. But I've been working on that for the past 3 years, and we're excavating at the Kahal Grande, the Kahal Shalom, and what seems to be the earliest synagogue that was built by the city wall. And then a church was built on top. So one of our specialties is that we work on the stratigraphy of synagogues, not as they were in 1944, but how they were 2 generations ago, 3 iterations ago. We use ground-penetrating radar, and then we use a new form of tomography, like an MRI for the ground, where we can look through the different layers of a synagogue and then find areas that are earlier than the layer that everybody else knows, 19th century, 20th century. And then what we try to do is we try to excavate very precisely so we can get some information on what the synagogue looked like, for example, in Rhodes in the 14th century, in the 15th century.
Can you speak a little bit more about those new techniques? Because they sound very exciting. So, they're non-invasive, really.
Right.
You don't have to dig up the whole town.
Yeah, so this is really the new cutting edge of archaeology. Archaeology is unfortunately one of the most destructive sciences on Earth. In order to excavate something, you basically have to cut through it or destroy it. So it would be great if we had a technique to tell us where to excavate and where not to excavate. And that's what these 2 technologies that we've been using for the past 20 years does. For example, ground-penetrating radar uses radar like FM radio waves. It's then shot into the ground with a machine. It then comes back through a fiber optic into a computer that translates everything that's below the surface. And for example, we can see structures. We can see down to about 6 meters, about 18 feet. And then what we can do is we can say, oh, look, there are structures here. Let's excavate this wall. Or, for example, in the case of electrical resistivity tomography, which uses electricity. And, you know, these are technologies that were available for gas and oil exploration, but we decided to use them for archaeology. Now, the ERT or the tomography can go down to 60 meters, 50 meters, you know, 150 feet, 180 feet. I mean, to depths where we can go from the top of a city block and we can see that there was a synagogue or a structure or a mikveh or some very definable structure below the surface. And then what we can do is we can make a plan of how to excavate without doing so much damage. I'll tell you, in the case of Lithuania, I'll just tell you, this is a great story because it's now being filmed for a documentary. Last year I was there in 1944. The great synagogue of Vilna was destroyed. And when the Soviets came in, they just basically plowed over the entire area where this great synagogue had been. And they then built an elementary school on top. And the elementary school is still sitting there. So a very clever archaeologist there said, you know, maybe we could see whether there is any remnants of the great synagogue still available for excavation. Then we could excavate it, we could know it, and maybe not have to destroy the school. What we didn't realize, and this is what we realized when we started doing the work, the great synagogue was built in the 17th and 18th century, two floors down from the street level, because they wanted to make the height greater than any other institution in town. So basically, the entire great synagogue is still there.
Wow.
Underneath this school. So what we're doing is we're going to do an excavation to see what areas of the school we can excavate, you know, like the playground, without having to do any damage to the school. So this is really the cutting edge of archaeology.
Now, what about in places, I mean, what immediately comes to mind is a place like Israel where you have layers upon layers of one civilization on top of another.
Right. So, I mean, for example, I'm excavating two places right now. One is called Nazareth, the city of Nazareth, where everybody knows that, very famous in the first century. Well, it's very difficult to excavate in Nazareth because people live there. They're living, they have businesses, they have. And so a few years ago, someone in their business said, you know, we were digging out our basement and we found a bathhouse. Can you help us figure out who built it, when it was built? And so what we did was, without destroying the person's business, we were able to excavate around the areas in the person's business to figure out what the bathhouse looked like. And then you can extract artifacts, and of course, then you can analyze it, you know, a lot more about the site. You know, in Israel, when people think about the different layers, one of the biggest problems of excavating is, where do you start? You know, I've been working on one site in Israel, in the northeast shore of the Sea of Galilee, where there are six strata that go down about 3,000 years. And when we started using ground-penetrating radar, every year when we excavate, we know that we're excavating something that we know what we're excavating. Before we stick a shovel in the ground, we know that we're going to be finding a floor. We know that we're going to be finding an oven. We know we're going to be finding a door. And it helps enormously, because not only is archaeology destructive, it's also very labor intensive and very expensive. I mean, I had to have, I think we had 50 students there this summer, and 50 students over 30 years. You can see how many students have been hauling dirt. And the best thing about when they do it in Israel with us, they know that they're going to find something. because we don't excavate anything that we don't know is already something there.
So you always work with students?
Unless we're doing, like, for example, we're working in Rhodes. I've now been there three times with students. We take small groups of students, and because it's very hands-on, and we also, it's a teaching excavation. We want the students to learn why archaeology, hands-on experience in recovering ancient history, really can change their lives. It's not like sitting in a library or sitting at a computer or playing, you know, games. It's something that can change their lives. They're very, very intuitive when they're dealing with artifacts in the field. It's amazing also how they love to be able to be a part of the technology.
So what happens when you find, let's say, a place that has six layers, and in order to get down to the second or third or fourth, you have to, I guess, destroy the ones that are on top of it?
Well, no, we don't have to do that. We find ways of going in from the side, from a different angle. See, before all archaeology, everybody started from the Acropolis, from the top, and worked their way down 2 inches at a time. So you did destroy everything as you went down because you didn't know what you were excavating. But what we do is we do not excavate unless we know there's something there, and then we know exactly where it is. So this kind of pinpoint archaeology means you don't have to destroy different layers to get to the layer where you want to excavate. So, for example, we're working at a site that's a Roman fishing village on the northeast shore of the Sea of Galilee. We're interested in the Roman period, but what we discovered was there was also an Iron Age city that goes back even 1,000 years earlier underneath that. So every once in a while, when we see a feature from the Iron Age village or city, what we do is we can go to that layer. We can then map it in, and we do digital mapping, which is very important because then each one of the changes that we make, you know exactly where all the artifacts were taken from. And somebody could come back in 50 years from now and still know exactly what layer we were working on. But the difference is that we don't have to be excavating entirely an entire surface and destroying an entire surface and then putting it back together, which is really what you have to do in archaeology. You first take it apart, you analyze it, and then you put it back together. You reconstruct it. In this case, we will take a small corner and excavate it, know what's there. And sometimes that layer will just stay open, or sometimes that layer will be closed, and then we'll be basically working on the Roman period, which is above it.
Can you tell us what you've done in Spain? I know you've been in at least two places, in Burgos and Cádiz.
Well, I've been in Burgos, I've been in Cádiz, I was in Tarifa, I was in Jaén. Oh, and we were looking at other. What's called here is very interesting. What's called here prehistory sites, because there was a significant Phoenician and pre-Phoenician group that came to Spain. Spain was an extremely important part of the Mediterranean trade. So we're looking at these prehistorical sites. Many of the Spaniards, you know, who I talked to, are just really amazed because usually in Spain they talk about the Greek period, they talk about the Roman period, they talk about the Byzantine period, the medieval period, but they don't talk so much about the Bronze Era. It's very important, the Chalcolithic period, which is about 6,000 years ago. And there were people here, and you know, most people have heard of these great cave paintings, the great cave drawings of Altamira and other places. What they don't understand is there was a continuous group of peoples that populated Spain from 40,000 years ago, right up through the modern period. Really, it's a very exciting place to excavate. And I'm working with local archaeologists to help them use the technology that we've been using.
I also read that you have done, or you're doing, a research project at the Sobibor death camp.
This is the good thing about being able to work with non-invasive technology. About a decade ago, a colleague of mine was trying to figure out how to excavate an extermination camp that basically is just sitting in a forest in Poland. It's on the eastern border. And he was really stumped because it's very hard to excavate at an extermination camp because there's so many people who are buried there, and you want to be able to deal dignified with the burials that are there and not to be digging up people. But you do want to collect as much information as possible on these extermination camps because we don't have that many extermination camps where they have not been changed over time. And for scholars of the Holocaust to see what the foundations of an extermination camp looked like when it was built, how it was built, what the gas chambers looked like, what the railroad tracks coming in, and how the people were directed, all the details that archaeology can give you, it's really one of the best sciences to help preserve and, I think, combat those people who have great suspicion about the evidence of the Holocaust. So it turns out that Sobibor was an extermination camp that there was a great escape in 1943, and the Nazis were so embarrassed by the escape from Sobibor, they closed the camp immediately in November after the escape, and they covered it with dirt, ironically preserving it perfectly for all time. So what we did was we did our first subsurface scans in 2008, 2009, and subsequently they excavated all of the installations without having to dig up any bodies. Wow. And really it's a case in point of the way that archaeology in the period of the Holocaust can give us so much more information than we ever knew.
I've seen that you've written 6 books on archaeology and 2 on Jewish ethics. And I was wondering what the relationship is for you.
Well, first of all, I'm a professor. I'm the Greenberg Professor of Jewish History and Director of Judaic Studies at the University of Hartford. And what that means is we give a degree in Judaic Studies. We also have a joint degree that we do with the University of Connecticut in Judaic Studies. And to study Judaic Studies means that you have to study everything in Jewish history, ethics, philosophy, and sociology, literature, languages, and that's what we do. So my own interest has been, since I study the historical periods, is to do almost like a stratigraphic archaeological version of how the ethical versions of the different ethics of Judaism have changed over time. So my 2 books on Jewish ethics, part 1 and part 2, really deal with historical issues, and not so much that I'm trying to give pronouncements or tell people what to do. I'm telling them that, for example, in such and such period, this is what people thought about homosexuality. This is what people thought about abortion. This is what people thought about self-sacrifice. This is what people thought about suicide. And what I do is I go through the different historical layers of textual information, and then I sometimes bring in material culture where we have examples of burials, and it tells us of the way people actually lived. So it's really one big connected part for people who study Judaic studies. It's important to know history. It's important to know material culture, but it's also important to know philosophy.
But Jewish ethics is not the same for everybody who's Jewish. Even now, I mean, even now you have groups that feel one way, let's say, about homosexuality, and groups that feel another way.
Right. So
Jewish ethics.
I don't do that. I don't get into the modern debates. I, for example, will contextualize what's written. When people come up to me and say, what's written in the Bible? I say, what's written in the Bible in Leviticus or Deuteronomy is X. How did they come to those understandings? It was written in a time when people existed in the ancient Near East. And so I go to ancient Near Eastern texts and I find out what they thought. And at no time am I trying to make any pronouncements for modern people to live their lives. But what's important is when people tell me that they think they understand what the ancient Near East was all about, or what the Bible is saying, I say, well, there's one way that we understand it in Judaism through Jewish commentators, who tell us what they understood these things to mean and that became the rabbinic understanding of those pronouncements. But what I write about is totally about the historical development of these ideas in their historical context. So it's quite a bit different than the modern historical debates, which I rarely get into. You know, I always am very interested to see how people will take a Talmudic text was written in the 5th and the 6th century and then interpret it in the 16th century. But that is a totally different process than what I'm talking about.
This is something that I've always had my own questions about, because we know what happened 2,000 years ago by what we can read that was written 2,000 years ago by right. certain people who wrote it 2,000 years ago, but we really right. don't know what everybody else was thinking at the time, if they didn't write it down and if it didn't right. come down to us.
But, you know, that is what material culture can do. Material culture can tell you what the popular understanding of things were. You know, I give you a good example from Buddhist ethics, okay, so that we don't get bogged down in I have a friend who does Buddhist archaeology, and we all know that the Buddhists do not see the person of the Buddha as a god. Mm-hmm. But what do we find when we dig in Buddhist sites? We find all these little god images all over the place. So I once asked a Buddhist archaeology professor what it is that he makes out of this. He says they don't think that he was a god, and yet they make all these little statuettes of Buddha. And he said, you know what? There is something very different of what people need in popular religion versus what they write about in professional texts. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they need a little statue. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they need a little statue. It gives them a little help. And that's what material culture can be about, is that when I find things, for example, in one of the sites that we're working at, Bethsaida, is a site that is clearly a Jewish and Greek period site. And we find all of these little statuettes also. So, you know, when I ask a traditional religious Jew what they think these little statuettes are, he says, maybe they were playing with them like dolls. And I said, or maybe every once in a while they needed a little help. And they went to things that they knew were not blessed by their forefathers and foremothers, but they still needed some help. And that's why when I find these little gods and goddesses in what would be Israelite homes or later early Jewish homes, I don't castigate them, or I don't say they can't be Jews. Mm. What I say is what we don't know is the way that people lived their lives exactly in antiquity. And so, for example, when we look at a single site, we come there, it's good to have textual information, because the textual information does give you a direction. But at the end of the day, you have to understand that people lived their lives, and not always were they always meeting the highest standards of textual information.
Getting back to this new project in Vilna, do you have any other future projects in mind?
Well, every single year when I go back to a place, for example, when I was there last year and I showed the Lithuanians what we were doing, they said, you know, we have a site that we'd like your help on. And we spent the day out at the Ponary burial pits, about 10 kilometers outside of Vilna. And I have to say, first of all, it was extremely, extremely moving for my students. Here we were in the middle of a forest, again, in Lithuania, and there were 100,000 people that were shot by Einsatzgruppen from 1941 until 1944 over burial pits. And they were all, there was no extermination camps, they just killed them in burial pits. And then they closed them up, and so the head of the area, it's now a museum, he said, you know, we would really like to know where all the dead bodies are. Can you tell us where all the dead bodies are? And, you know, I said, actually, we can tell you the parameters of how large these pits were. so that you don't do any indignities when you do development of this site. But we're not going to be excavating them so that you can see the remains. We'll just be able to tell you, for example, for the tomography can actually tell us that there are, they can distinguish between bone and stone and glass and metal and wood, because the resistivity tells us the different types of materials below the surface. So I can tell you that. Mm-hmm. Then he told me a story that I have to say even took me by surprise. He says, what we really like you to do is we would like you to find there was an escape from the burial pits on April 15th, 1944. 80 Jews had been digging their way out for 76 days out of the pits, and they escaped, and 11 of them survived and lived to tell the tale. And we'd like to see if the escape tunnel is still there.
So that's what you're going to look for.
That's one of the things we're looking for.
Okay, I'm afraid we're out of time. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, that's it for this week. As always, we'd love to hear from you. So please email us any comments or suggestions or questions you'd like us to answer on the air. Our address is English Corner at RadioSephirod.com. See you next week.